privacy on a plane, internet security regulations, Instagram influencers, and Facebook goes to Congress. That's all coming up in some of our favorite interviews of the year on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 63, recorded Thursday, November 29th, for December 27th, 2018.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show every week. We talk to the most interesting people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. We would not miss a single week. We would not do this.
No, I told Leo that I would come in, and you were like, well, I'm busy, I'm family, blah, blah, blah. And so we decided to record earlier.
Family? What's that?
So we're recording this a little bit earlier. We decided we picked some of the best interviews, our favorite interviews.
Yeah, our favorites. You know, we talk to 3, 4, sometimes 5 people an episode every single week for this show. We talk to a lot of interesting people, so it's hard to pick. Mm-hmm. And some of the stories feel very topical and in the moment, but then some of them are a little bit broader, surprise stories that, you know, maybe aren't like the top of the news cycle, but are very interesting. So we kind of went through everything and came up with a few of our favorites.
Yeah. And so the first one, I just remember giggling a lot during this. This was Sandra Davidson. She is a lawyer, and she spoke to us about privacy. You might remember, do you remember the Plain Bay?
Oh, I remember
incident?
Plain Bay. And this was one of those interviews that I was kind of like, oh yeah, this will be kind of interesting. And then at the end of it, I was like, that was an amazing interview.
Yeah. And I think it was partly one of my favorites because it just shows what situation we're in right now where like people are just taking pictures of people in public spaces, and then it could lead to ruining their lives, and what is the, you know, legal ramifications of that. So let's take a look. A passenger on a flight from New York to Dallas sent a thread of tweets about an overheard conversation of a couple seated near her. The story went viral and started out heartfelt, but ended like so many things end on Twitter these days, as a cautionary tale about privacy in public spaces with the hashtag Plain Bay.
Plain Bay.
Dr. Sandra Davidson is here. She's a communications law expert at the University of Missouri, an expert in privacy law in the media. Thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Davidson.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
So when you first heard of the hashtag Plain Bay story, what were your first thoughts about this?
Well, we are in such a new situation with technology, just rampant, you know, the notion of when do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy keeps shrinking and shrinking as technology keeps leaping forward. So you just have to beware. What can we say?
So what about what expectation do I have? I guess what legal expectation do I have of privacy on an airplane?
The reasonable expectation of privacy is the highest when you're in your home or your office. It's at its lowest when you're out on a public street, someplace like that, where anybody can be walking by and seeing you. When you are in a plane, or let's say you're at your workplace and there are other people around, here's the question. A reasonable expectation of privacy, does it exist? Well, not concerning the people who are around you. They can see you, they can hear you. But the question becomes, what about a reasonable expectation of privacy concerning the rest of the world? And we had an interesting case in California. It ended up ending in 2000. But here was the situation. Some psychics, air quotes, were talking about their psychic network and saying basically it was a bunch of hogwash. They did not know that the person sitting next to them had been hired, but she was actually an ABC reporter. Now, if they'd been a psychic, really, they would have known that
true.
They were. Yeah. So here's what happened. One of the psychics, when this broadcast went nationwide, fell off the wagon. He was a recovering alcoholic. He died. But the other one lived to sue and collect. The jury came back with a $1.2 million judgment. The California Supreme Court said, well, we will say that if you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy concerning the people around you, it may still be a question of whether you have a reasonable expectation of privacy concerning the rest of the world. And it doesn't make any difference if we're talking about broadcast or if we're talking about, you know, a Twitter or any other kind of live streaming. In this case, ABC settled out of court. So this surviving psychic walked away with over $900,000.
Yeah, I mean, the lines are so blurred right now. And I know that, you know, as a generation, we're many, many years into, you know, reality TV being a very influential thing.
Yes.
I don't know I don't watch much TV anymore, so I don't know how strong the pull of reality TV is now. But I know, you know, over the past 10, 15, 20 years, it's been pretty darn strong. Then you've got the potent, you know, platform that is social media, and the idea of network effect, and how something may seem so anonymous in the beginning, and you put it out there because, I don't know, I only have, you know, 40 followers. There's whatever. There's no harm. This is a cool, funny story, but that can, you know, that can completely blow up. Like somebody in this case was doxxed, and you know,
yes,
that can happen. That can be kind of a side effect that you didn't see, you didn't think about when you first kind of went down this road. Is there any legal recourse for someone who is like on the other side, like say the two people, and I realize the guy in this situation went on to go on like you know, Good Morning America. He made a
yes,
big public splash of himself, but it was the woman in this situation that wanted to be kept relatively anonymous, and I think she was doxxed. Does she have any legal recourse about the fact that this person tweeted this out and it led to that?
Okay, let's talk about unsocial media. Here's another form of invasion of privacy. We were talking about intrusion into seclusion. Now let's talk about private facts. Let's say that the people on the plane were talking and they got into some very private, embarrassing information, maybe some medical information. Maybe one person is saying, I'm married, but I'm going to dump my spouse who doesn't know it yet, whatever. Under the private facts invasion of privacy, there are two questions that are asked. The first one is actually a two-parter, and that is, would this information be highly offensive to a reasonable person? If you're super sensitive, the courts say, get a thicker skin, and if it's just mildly offensive, again, get over it. But there's also a second question. And that's this: is what is being disseminated newsworthy? That means, is it of legitimate public concern? If it's of legitimate public concern, you can disseminate it even if it would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. But now if you have a couple of private people talking about a private matter that is highly offensive to a reasonable person, then that is not newsworthy, and that's private facts invasion of privacy. Now, if the people sitting on the plane are famous, maybe they're politicians, it might be that what they're saying it would be highly offensive to a reasonable person, but yet it is still of legitimate public concern. And then the law would say it's all right to disseminate it.
Has the law really caught up with the way we see fame right now? Because I think that what I understand is they found this woman because they knew it was a professional, some sort of professional soccer player who she was talking to.
Yes.
But
yes.
I mean, we, you know, there are live streamers. I mean, there's us, like, you know, there's all kinds of people. You know, what is famous, and has the law caught up to what that means? I mean, just because I know that, you know, live streamers, people show up at their house, or, you know, it's much easier for like a man to live stream than it is often for a woman, because it's, you know, a sense of safety because it's so easy to find people.
Yes.
What has the law caught up with what it means to be famous?
Well, there has been a problem with that for a long time, and it's developed with libel law, the concept that if you are a public figure, then you would have to prove actual malice, meaning intentional libel to be able to collect. If you're a private individual, if you can say that somebody was negligent, you know, they weren't using a standard of care that a reasonable person would use in similar circumstances, then you're okay. So the stakes are really great. Are you a public figure or are you a private individual? And the Supreme Court started talking in terms of, do you have pervasive fame or notoriety? And the court first started in talking about pervasive fame or notoriety in the community, and then a few years later kind of mucked it up by saying, well, in the community, if it's just like, you know, Palm Beach society, that's not enough. This was in a case involving a splashy divorce for the Firestone Tire heir. The Supreme Court keeps on chipping away at who would be a public figure. For instance, if you are a criminal, and I hope you're not, I hope this is just academic, but you would not be a public figure for purposes of commenting on your crime. What you have to do is thrust yourself into the vortex of a public issue, basically. So what constitutes thrusting? If you decide, for instance, that you're going to campaign on an issue, maybe you're a vegetarian or whatever, and then the court might say you're a public figure for purposes of commenting on the vegetarianism aspect of your life, but not for other aspects of your life. So if somebody said, okay, you purported vegetarian, you have fur coats. Well, I have a lot of fur coats, but they're occupied. Okay, dogs and guinea pigs. Anyway, for the purpose of talking about the issue you've injected yourself into, then you are public. For all other purposes, you're private. But if you are, say, Beyonce, you've arrived. Oprah, you've arrived. You are a public person for all circumstances, so your conversation on a plane would probably be of public interest.
One of the questions that I have around this and kind of the legal lines that it seems to straddle is whether it was wrong for this to have been posted at all, or whether it was wrong that once it was posted, it got so much attention. Like, if somebody had posted this and it had gone to 40 people and it had never made the news, would there still be a similar, you know, thread of guilt there, or a similar rule that was being broken in that regard? I don't know. And is there any legal, like, from a legal standpoint, people who retweet or get involved in that, you know, sense, do they, what kind of blame do they share on this?
All right, let's talk about 40 versus 40 million. What you can be talking about is the degree of damages, which, of course, the jury will be awarding. And then when it comes to republication of the material, it, again, kind of depends on who you are if you're going to have liability. Let's say that you are an internet service provider and somebody is posting this kind of stuff on your service. The Congress has given protection. It's called Section 230 protection under the Communications Decency Act. You're protected. You don't have liability for what third parties are doing. But, of course, you do have liability for what you yourself do. Mm-hmm. So a republication, a retweeting or whatever, yes, you're disseminating it too.
But Twitter itself has no legal responsibility in this.
Well, as long as you are a service provider, no. As long as you're not engaged in sex trafficking, because mm-hmm. Congress made just a recent little amendment to that law.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could keep asking you questions all night, but thank you so much for joining us. And I assume that your dogs are wearing their own fur coats and your guinea pigs are wearing their own fur coats and not vice versa, right?
That's okay. Right. We have a very segregated household. Okay. The dogs cannot get around the guinea pigs.
Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Sandra Davidson, thank you so much. Where's the best place thank for people you. To follow your work online?
Well, I do a weekly column. So if you would just go to Sandy Davidson and also put Columbia, Missourian, that would get my columns.
Okay. We'll put that link in our show notes too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was funnier than the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
I will have to have her on again.
Yeah, she's really good. And she spoke really, really eloquently through the concept of this thing. Like, I remember when I first read the story, it was a crazy story, but she went into just kind of intricate detail into the legal ramifications around that. Just a lot of angles that I hadn't really considered. And she's really likable. Like, it was just a lot of fun to talk to her on that topic.
It really was. And I think there's room for commenting on Twitter about the awkward and uncomfortable things that are going on around you. Just no pictures, please.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me, too. The next interview was from episode 54. If you remember, we had security professional Bruce Schneier on the show. Also, check out the triangulation feed. You'll find an interview, me talking with Bruce Schneier in more of an expanded role for about an hour on some of these topics from the interview. This is kind of a shortened version of that interview where we really dived into how security as an idea on the internet is becoming so important that maybe there's a bigger need for regulation in this day and age. Online security breaches, high profile hacks, government agency insecurities. It really feels like the state of security is on high alert, constantly moving a mile a minute. It's almost impossible to keep up. Our next guest argues that things are only going to get worse, and he should know. Welcome to the show, cryptographer, lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, and author of the new book that we happen to have right here, Click Here to Kill Everybody, Bruce Schneier. How are you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing great. How's everybody?
I was good until I read the title of your book, and then I was scared.
I mean, the title is really just meant to like reel you in the bookstore. I kind of back off at page three, but you know, this is what we're talking about.
Absolutely. So you, we're bringing you on today partially because of the book. It's very apropos to the topic that you wrote about in an op-ed for the New York Times last week. You posited there that security has become too important, too difficult for the free market to enforce on its own. What's different now from even 5 or 10 years ago that's making security so incredibly difficult at this point?
So what I talked about in the article and also in the book is our relationship with computers are changing. They're no longer screens that we go to deliberately and deal with data. They're objects in our environment that affect the world. So I talk about autonomy, automation, and physical agency. What's changing is computers now do stuff in our world. They drive our cars. They turn our thermostats on. They send life-saving electricity into our hearts to revive us when we have a problem. And that just makes it different. It's not about data. It's about life and property. So what's changing is how computers are being used. We're trying to use the same old security in this new environment, and that's going to fail.
So speaking of failing, you have some tenets. You do write in the book about what a secure internet might look like, and you have these tenets, which are all great, and some which I would assume are obvious, but apparently are not. One of the most interesting ones is that our machines should fail, our computers should fail gracefully, safely, and predictably. So what does that look like for example, the Schlage lock that locks my front door, which I love because then none of my children need keys and we just use a code to get in and out. So when that fails, how would it fail predictably and safely and not destroy my home, lock me out or in or something like that?
Well, maybe it fails that it has a key also. So it's not only electronic. And I'm making this up. The problem is, as you describe, that this is a computer. The computer can be hacked. It can fail. Lots of things can happen. And you don't want to be locked out of your house. So maybe there is some manual override, some manual backup, where if the electronic part doesn't work, you can still get in. Mm. Right, failing gracefully, you think of it as fail safe. Right, when you take your foot off the accelerator, The car slows down. It doesn't, when you take your hand off the steering wheel, it doesn't veer to the left. It just tends to go straight. And those kind of mechanisms are pretty common in safety. We have them less in security. Right? Fail in some safe and secure manner. Don't fail in some catastrophic manner. Some of it's going to be design, right? Don't have a default password so that all the things don't fail at once. Some of it is kind of these manual overrides. I've heard it called Faraday mode. If I have an internet-connected refrigerator and the internet goes down, I want the refrigerator to still keep things cold. So it's going to mean different things in different contexts.
Obviously, the Schlage lock is just one example of this whole IoT craze that's a really, you know, really big deal, big movement. We're kind of, on one hand, we're in a moment in time where, you know, computers enable us to do so many things that seemed like science fiction years ago. Yet here we are, and it's great that that's happening. But IoT seems to be kind of the critical point in all of this, right? Is it the sleeping giant? Is it a problem that can't be ignored anymore? And why has it failed in terms of security so hard?
You know, it's interesting. It is the big thing. It is us moving computers into our environment. You know, you just read the numbers. It's going to be huge. It'll be bigger than computers and phones. It'll be how we interact with computing, with the internet. I think it's going to change a lot of things. And why it's failing is an interesting question. Some of it is that these non-computer manufacturers are becoming computer manufacturers. A lot of the lessons we learned the hard way with computers are now being learned again with refrigerators and appliances and toys and even cars. Some of it is that these computers are being designed differently at a lower profit margin. You know, we have a team of engineers at Apple and Google and Microsoft writing patches when our computers and phones fail. There isn't that team for home routers or internet-connected toys or webcams like what I'm speaking to you on. They don't have security teams. They can't be patched. They're a much lower cost. The economics is completely different. We've built our security around the old economics.
And I mean, the idea was originally everything should be able to connect to the internet because that, right. You know, that was the magic of it back in the day. And I mean, that's sort of still the same thing. Like, I want my smart home. I want everything to connect easily. It's super frustrating when it doesn't. I want everything to be on HomeKit with Apple, and there's a lot of stuff that doesn't work, and I'm told that's because it's less secure, and that's frustrating too. So, I mean, what is it? What does it look like? What is the secure internet look like besides those tenets that you outline that I mentioned before, the ones that should be obvious, vendors not shipping stuff with vulnerabilities, which I guess still happens. What are some other ways that the secure internet will look like in the future if everyone obeys your rules?
Well, I don't think it'll be by disconnecting things, right? The internet is coming to all these objects and it is the future and it's a great idea and it'll cause all sorts of benefits we can't imagine. So really, how do we build resilience? Right? How do we design our internet so that there are these devices that will be insecure, will have vulnerabilities, will be hacked, and it isn't a catastrophe? Right? Because so we can imagine our something in our home that is monitoring everything else. We can manage. We can imagine ways to fail safely or securely. I generally think of it as resilience. How do we build more resilient systems? We're not going to conserve our way out of this. We're not going to say, you know, don't have internet connected this and that, because you're right. This is the promise. This is the future. And it's what we're going to have. How do we build security anyway? I mean, there are real engineering challenges. I argue that they are go to the moon hard and not faster than light travel hard. But really, my book is about policy. What kind of policies do we need to incent companies not to ship software with the vulnerabilities? You know, and that's going to be where we have to push our effort. It's not going to be smart consumers paying more. It's going to be regulations. It's the way we get security in cars and airplanes and pharmaceuticals and everything else.
So regulations, obviously, and you know, I know that you talk a lot about that. You definitely talked about that a little bit in the op-ed. What that kind of brings me back to, though, is that product manufacturers, you know, there's a lot of people that work at these on these teams that create all these products. And there's a lot of money being made. It's just kind of a bummer that, like, they didn't have the foresight to think about all this stuff so that we don't necessarily need to move into a world of regulation. Like, why are they dropping the ball so hard when there's so many capable people within these businesses to actually pay enough attention to this sort of stuff and to realize that it's important?
I mean, the market doesn't reward security. The market rewards quick, the market rewards cheap, the market rewards functions. And security is an afterthought, and some of you don't even get that. Equifax, Yahoo, I mean, lots of examples of companies that ignored security or at least underspent on security. I mean, that's what the market gives you. Now, a good regulation, if you do this right, spurs the market. If there is some rule that security has to be higher, companies will appear, things will be purchased, there'll be innovation in security. I mean, right now there's no real benefit. If my product's more secure than yours and it costs, you know, 1.5 as much and is 6 months late to market, I'm done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
What do you make of this story that's now about 3 weeks old, the Bloomberg story, chip story that never, like, we've never heard any proof, but I assume that you think that this is something that could happen, whether it really did happen in this particular way. But what do you make of Apple and, you know, and Facebook and these companies just saying that, or not Facebook, but Apple and I guess Amazon.
Yeah.
Saying this didn't happen. There's no way that it could happen. Or I guess they just said it didn't happen. What do you make of that?
I mean, this is a hard story. This is a supply chain security story. And the allegation is that networking equipment made in China was backdoored, presumably by the government, and shipped to the U.S., where it made its way into Apple, Amazon, and other data centers. This is a big problem. I mean, not necessarily this story. I actually think this story is not true only because I haven't seen a photo of one yet.
Yeah.
If this happened, if it was common, we would see a picture by now. But the general problem is common. Remember some months ago, Kaspersky? Should we trust Russian-made antivirus programs? Or around the same time, Huawei and ZTE? Should we trust Chinese-made phones and networking equipment? The problem is that our supply chain is so international and anybody can subvert it. Right? I use an iPhone, but it's not made in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Its chips don't come from the U.S. Programmers of that device carry 100 and something passports. So it is very international. And these supply chain risks are real. They're real for military. They're real for corporations. I mean, the U.S. inserted backdoors into Cisco equipment destined for the Syrian telephone company. We learned that from a Snowden document. Right? Again and again, we see these kind of supply chain attacks. They're pretty much impossible to discover. There are lots of ways to do this pretty much undetectably. And it's a problem we basically ignore. Bloomberg's story is just one example. And the fact that we don't know one way or the other is actually part of the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're talking about regulation, you mentioned in your piece, the New York Times, that the EU, you know, has done some work here and they might act as a good model of what regulation would look like in this space on a broader scale. Why has the EU devoted enough time to this, whereas other parts of the world have not? Like, why is the EU setting this example and others still haven't learned that lesson?
I mean, the why, you should find some political scientists to talk about that. I mean, the what is that the EU is the regulatory superpower on the planet right now. And they are willing to fine internet companies real money. And they regulated privacy, GDPR. It's why you're getting a lot more warnings on websites these days.
Right.
And they're going to approach security. In the U.S., I look to the states. California just passed an IoT security bill. Mm-hmm. It's not that great, but it's a start. New York, Massachusetts are looking at similar things. And I think what you find is that a rising tide helps everybody. Yeah. I mean, just like you see warnings because of a European regulation, that California IoT bill will make our stuff more secure regardless of where it's sold. It means the economics of software. If you make the security improvement, you might as well sell it everywhere. And so I'm relatively optimistic, even though at the federal level, the U.S. government is probably not going to do anything. But I mean, here's the real argument. I think we are past the point of regulation versus no regulation, that the argument is smart regulation versus stupid regulation. Right? Governments regulate things that kill people. Once the internet can start killing people, government will regulate it. They're going to regulate it for cars, for appliances, for consumer goods, power plants, airplanes, medical devices, and then into everything else.
Yeah, and there's nothing to say that it's not already there. It just hasn't been used in that case, in that way, in such a broadly like recognized and obvious scenario that the government would feel like it has to act in that way. It's a really good point. Bruce Schneier, you're awesome, and we really appreciate bringing you on the show. You're actually going to be a guest on our long-form interview show, A Triangulation, next Friday, October 26th, along with Leo Laporte, so we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, if you can find it, check out the new book. Click here to click everybody.
Or, to kill everybody.
Click here to kill everybody.
Forget that subtitle.
That was a little redundant. Click here to kill everybody, which is a fantastic title. And people should also follow you on your blog. Where can they go to find that?
They're seeing it on the screen, Schneier on Security. Just type my name into Google and it'll find it.
Bruce, we really appreciate you taking time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. So then, at the end, what do you think? Regulation. Is it the answer, Megan?
I think that we're going to require some regulation. I think it's just too big of a problem.
Yeah, I would agree. And if Bruce Schneier thinks it's also too big of a problem, I tend to agree with his perspective on security. So
yeah, exactly. Another favorite guest of mine, all of them are
every single one of them. They're all amazing.
We had our next guest on at least two times. I would love to have her on every week. She has the most interesting beat. She Taylor Loren. She writes for The Atlantic, and she covers a lot of like teen issues, teens on Instagram and Snapchat and Amazon. And it's just she had this crazy piece that I think you found on The Atlantic that was about the amount of money that these teen influencers are making. And it was so interesting to talk to her about it.
Teens across the country are trading in their summer jobs for fall classrooms, or so I thought. Some of them are. Others will probably continue working their summer jobs indefinitely, possibly even from the classroom, I don't know, when they return, as they continue monetizing their Instagram accounts. Joining us to talk about this new kind of summer job is Taylor Lorenz from The Atlantic. Welcome, Taylor.
Hi, guys.
It's so great to have you here. Thank you for joining us. So, first of all, tell us a little bit about how these teens are kind of becoming the facilitators of sponsored content on Instagram. I didn't even realize this was happening.
Yeah. So basically, sorry, I'm a little low here. Let me fix this. That's this good. Okay?
Yeah, it looks great.
Okay. So basically, I mean, more and more brands are looking to work with sort of regular, I guess, quote unquote, regular teens instead of traditional influencers. They feel like it's just more organic. The teens do a good job of promoting it. It seems more natural to have like a post from your friend, promoting something as opposed to something from some aspirational influencer. So they're sort of like reaching out more directly to these teens on Instagram and offering them sponsored deals.
Of all the things that I thought I would have to teach my teenagers, I didn't think it was don't use your friends to sell stuff. But apparently that is something that, I mean, because does that come, I know you talk to a lot of teenagers, does that come naturally to them? Do they understand like, wow, like all these people are following me because they want to see me, just have fun throughout my day, and then I'm using them to sell a product?
I don't think they think of it that way. I don't think that they think of it as using anyone. I think they just sort of like, I think teens increasingly kind of recognize their own sort of cultural capital that they have from being a teen. Brands want to work with them. So it's not really seen as like selling out or spammy in the same way. So, I mean, like most kids I talk to, like if their friend did a brand deal, they were like, oh, that's awesome. Like get money. Like, sure, I would do the same thing. Like also asking their friend to put them in touch. So I think it's kind of like they don't really care. A lot of them have multiple Instagram accounts too. So it's not like, this huge thing where they're suddenly like spamming all their best friends.
So talking about, friends on Instagram, how many are we talking about here? Because I mean, in the old guard, I would say, there was a lot of emphasis on you've got to have amassed this huge follower count. But I mean, I'm just guessing a lot of these, the kids that are agreeing to do this probably don't have hundreds of thousands of followers, right? They have a select few. Is it more about quality versus quantity?
Yeah, I mean, they might have like 800 to 1,000 followers, which is like way not that much. Maybe they'll have 2,000, 3,000. These brands are pretty much eager to work with any teens that have an organic audience of other teens. So, they don't, and they're only paying like $5, $10. So they don't, it's not a huge they don't really need somebody with that much skill. They don't really want someone that seems almost more inauthentic to have that kind of skill. So, yeah, it's a lot of teens that are just sort of have a few thousand followers. I mean, some kids, of course, have more like 20,000, or some kids have like a meme account that they've grown bigger, that they're monetizing. But for the most part, they're kind of like, the kids are like 10,000 followers or under, which is not very much for a teen.
Mm-hmm. So they don't feel like they're selling out. So is there a downside to this? I mean, I know you write about how some teens are taking advantage of, there aren't a lot of contracts. Can you talk a little bit about how the shadiness that might be going on among these advertisers and teenagers?
Yeah, so there's obviously a lot of room for, you know, shady behavior and for these companies to take advantage of the kids. You know, there was this huge blow up with this account called So Aesthetic Shop. Which was this online retailer that was refusing to pay all of these teens. And over 20 girls had actually done work for So Aesthetic and not received payment. And the people were sort of bullying them. Like, the owner of the account would just block them when they asked for their money. And, you know, they were doing a lot of hours of unpaid labor. And so that kind of, you know, predatory behavior is more common in these types of situations, just because, like, these girls are like 13 or 14 years old. They're not negotiating contracts. There's no adult supervision. So, you know, sometimes they can get taken advantage of. They kind of accept that. Like, the girls I talked to were like, yeah, even if like 10% of the, you know, deals I do, I'd end up not getting paid for, like, I'm still getting money in my pocket. So,
yeah, getting money using social media. Like, I imagine, you know, especially as a teen, like, that's kind of a dream right there. Because, I mean, and there are a lot of, you know, a lot of people that they are following who are doing the same thing, you know, like, you know, stars, you know, celebrities, they're using these platforms to do just that. So it's almost a way for them to kind of connect on that level and be like, yeah, I'm doing that too, making some money. Of course I'm going to be, you know, be happy to do that.
A lot of the places where these brands find these girls is in the comment section of popular YouTubers. So, you know, like, these teenagers will comment on popular YouTubers' Instagrams like, oh my God, you look so pretty, I love your hair, whatever. And a brand will like slide into their DMs like, hey, are you a teen? Like, you know, we want to work with you.
That sounds so ominous.
Hello,
so weird. I know. I was like, do you guys get creeped out? And they're like, not really. I don't care. Some of them made email addresses, but they're kind of like, they're getting the money over PayPal too. So, yeah, they kind of don't really care.
Yeah. Hey. All right.
Do you think their parents know that they're making this money?
Yeah, good question.
I would say 50-50. I talked to a lot of girls where their parents don't know. They have, you know, in some cases, hundreds of dollars in PayPal that they sort of use to shop online. And, you know, they buy the kind of stuff that's their parents probably wouldn't buy for them. And other girls, you know, did tell their parents. I interviewed a few parents who did know for the story, and they were all really proud of their kids. Like, you know, the one mom who I think I quoted was very nervous at first. She was like, what do you mean this brand is messaging my 13-year-old daughter? But once she sort of saw, you know, what her daughter was learning, she was proud. Like, a lot of the parents I spoke to were like, look, you know, is this kind of shady of the business to be paying my daughter $10? Yeah. But at the same time, it's teaching her business skills. It's teaching her marketing, sales requests. It teaches them responsibility. Like, these girls will have to deliver on their sponsored content by a certain date and, you know, get stuff together. So it sort of teaches them, I don't know, it teaches them really good skills. It's just, obviously, you know, none of them are going full. They're still balancing that with schoolwork and other things. So,
yeah, I mean, it's a very entrepreneurial, you know, it's like a window into an entrepreneurial world. Who knows what that blossoms into as they get older? That could be a big deal.
I mean, a lot of these kids, some of them are just like insane Instagram marketers. So, they'll just like, they have a very deep understanding of like social media marketing. Some of the kids, some of the stores, some of the retailers that pay these kids are actually run by teens themselves. So, a couple of kids that sort of got into sponsored content over the past few years were like, hey, why am I only getting paid $10 from these stores? I could just set up my own online store, market it with my other teen friends, and make a lot of money. Some kids have made tens of thousands of dollars that
That's
way.
So smart.
That's yeah.
Smart. Well, yeah. Okay, we're shifting gears entirely. Like, these two stories are completely different. But you posted, Taylor, you wrote earlier this week about how teens are increasingly more aware, more clued in on current events, particularly political events, and personally, like, it's awesome to see teens so engaged with politics. Yet what you're writing about, you tell us about how teens view politics and news media as they grow up socializing in social media. And there's not a whole lot of positive as far as how they view the news in light of where we are right now in the world of social media. Tell us a little bit about that.
So, I wrote a story basically about the ways that teens view media. It is negative in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, I think teens have huge, huge, huge skepticism, especially towards traditional news outlets. So, you know, there's all these like cries from the president and older people of fake news. And that's really carried over for a lot of teens, too. I mean, keep in mind, like, skepticism and sort of anger and negative associations with the mainstream media, like those levels are already very high within adults. So it is unsurprising that it would trickle down to teens, because teens are ultimately living in those households. And if they hear their parents saying stuff like that, they're going to naturally kind of be susceptible to it. But it's also the fact that, you know, they're growing up on the internet and they kind of don't believe anything they see. They kind of have like an innate skepticism towards things, which you would think would be good, but they have that skepticism carries so far into the fact that they question like actual reported news. You know, I think also they've seen how biased and sort of like headline, you know, like attention grabby certain headlines can be. They kind of are familiar with the whole viral content cycle. And so, yeah, they just don't really trust hard news sources very much the way that previous generations of kids did.
Well, did they? Because, I mean, I'm thinking of, like, trust no one over 35. Like, I mean, isn't this, a thing that, you know, everyone's generation experiences? How is it different?
Not to this extent. I mean, I think what's different now is that the media is sort of more saturated than ever. So while, you know, kids are always skeptical. Kids are always also, like, not believing what their parents say and kind of always, like, you know, there's, like, a huge counterculture. But I think the media environment right now has changed so much. So the fact that there are so many hyperpartisan sites and independent news journalists that are usually very partisan. So I think, like, kids pick up on that. And with social media and just, like, the fact that, like, there is rampant misinformation, I think that they're just way more skeptical. They also are more likely to seek out news from, like, individual people rather than, like, institutions. So they're more likely to trust, like, a YouTuber or a podcaster that they know really well and sort of know their biases, as opposed to, like, New York Times, where they feel like, you know, they're biased. They're just not admitting it.
Yeah, fascinating. And you also talk a little bit about political Instagram, which is another. Yeah. Apparently, I know nothing about Instagram, which, you know, I fully admit. But
the politics Instagram is really crazy and interesting. I want to do another story on like teen politics influencers, because it's this whole world.
Sure.
But it you know, I think like a lot of kids, they go onto social media by default to kind of find out more information about what they're reading. So Instagram is obviously a natural outlet for that. And Twitter, of course, too.
Yeah. Taylor Lorenz with The Atlantic. I'm a huge fan of your work. I really appreciate you taking time.
Thanks, guys. Sorry about the janky feed.
No, it's all good.
I appreciate you having me.
It all worked out, Taylor. And we'll talk to you soon. We'll reach out again. You write great stuff, so we'll follow you.
Take care. Thank you. Bye. I would like to be a teenage influencer.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, just think about all the opportunity that you have as a teenager now to make money, and it all involves staring at your phone, something you're already doing.
I was walking in downtown Petaluma just the other day, and there was this like nicely dressed, like in 20s guy, and then a woman who was wearing like these cute overalls and like that hat, and I was like, oh, they look like influencers, like Instagram influencers. And I was just thinking, like, what's wrong with me that I'm just like looking at people and I got, oh, they look like influencers.
So if you are an influencer, is that what you put on your LinkedIn account? That's a trick question. You don't have a LinkedIn account if you're an influencer.
Right.
Or actually, I don't know that if that's true.
It is a weird world. Influencer world.
It is a weird world where technology and everything is turned upside down. And that's exactly what we talked with Jeff Jarvis about on episode 48. You all know Jeff Jarvis, This Week in Google, and so much more. He came on to talk about, this was about the time that big tech was going to Washington, right? Executives from Twitter and Facebook went to Congress to testify in front of Congress. You may remember the empty chair that represented Google. Jeff Jarvis had a lot to say on that. So I was yesterday I was hosting This Week in Google in Leo's absence, and someone was missing from the panel. Someone who I knew would have plenty of thoughts on what I've been calling the tech reckoning. It's kind of an ominous name, as Twitter and Facebook bigwigs headed to Washington, D.C. To kind of atone for their ineffective handling of misuse on their networks. That man is Jeff Jarvis, professor at the CUNY School of Journalism, and he joins us here today. Welcome, hey. Jeff. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Awesome. It's great to get you on here. There's so much ground to cover, and we were talking about it yesterday, and I was like, I know Jeff's got thoughts on this. Absolutely. So this is your chance. So we saw Jack Dorsey and Sheryl Sandberg sit in the hot seat during this congressional hearing. What would you say has been the tone of the questions that were thrown at them, and how do you think they did in responding?
I was surprised because I was very nervous given prior hearings were all about seeing just how stupid our legislators are about the internet and how hostile they were. I think that it was a very different tone, except of course to Google, which we'll get to in a minute. But I think that the legislators were giving credit to Facebook and Twitter for trying, for moving ahead. They probably want to take credit for that. You know, we put you on the hot seat and you responded, fine, whatever. I think there was a bit more of a sense of pulling the oars in the same way. I saw most of the testimony. There was a chunk in the middle I missed, so there could have been some horrible moment that I missed. But all in all, I thought that the questions were respectful. And in terms of Sandberg and Dorsey, I think they both did very well. The only thing I wish they'd done was to remind people that the internet is not a flaming cesspool of crap. That most of the internet is wonderful. Good things happen. Social media enables Black Lives Matter and Me Too to occur. But that's my wishful thinking. I think what they did in all was accomplish the goal of saying we're trying. We care about this too. We want to work together. The fact that Congress came back and said, if there are things that are stopping you from working together, let us know. So I was quite pleasantly surprised.
Hmm. What did you think about Google's retort when it sent in an empty chair to speak on its behalf? what did you think about that? Was this a smart decision on Google's part? Yesterday on Twig, Stacey seemed to think that it really didn't matter much that whether Google sent someone or not, that they were making a statement that ultimately it wasn't going to matter as much. I'm definitely paraphrasing, but what's your thought?
Yeah, I think Stacey, as usual, is right. I was thinking about this yesterday. Will it matter in a month that Google wasn't there? No. Will people say, oh my God, Google didn't go before this hearing? No. I don't think so. Though, and so going into it, I thought, yeah, Google may win this test because what the heck? They're going to get skewered. They're going to have idiotic questions. Nothing's going to be accomplished. Google's smart not to be there. That was my impression going in. But given that the hearings turned out better than I thought, I think Google missed an opportunity to be there. And further, because Google was not there, it was an opportunity for various senators. One in particular went after them for, you know, maybe being nice to China, for not continuing the drone projects with the U.S. government. And so Google got smashed a little bit and didn't have an opportunity to respond. So in the end, I was wrong. I think that Google would have been wiser to be there, but I certainly understand why Google chose not to be.
I was surprised that Kamala Harris was there, and she was kind of busy yesterday. She's been busy in the last few days. I mean, that she was there to question Sandberg and ask, like, how much money have you made? How much money has Facebook made off of, you know, these Russian ads? I mean, what did you make of her questions and her being there and also at the Supreme Court hearings?
Yeah, I mean, she is our prosecutor extraordinaire, and I don't want to face her, man. I don't want to do anything wrong and see Kamala Harris staring at me. I've met her; she's a very nice person. But boy, if I've done anything wrong, keep me safe, because she is tough. But I think I didn't get to watch all of that. I got interrupted by a phone call in the middle of it. I think it's a bit of a bogus idea to say that the platforms want this manipulation and trolling because they make money off of it. It's bad for their brands. It's bad for their businesses. They're getting hauled forward before people because of just that stuff. So I think it's naive, purposefully naive, to say that they're making money. You know, this also goes back to when Al Franken pushed them in earlier hearings. And rubles! You should have seen the rubles! which, when you realize the scale of this, is absolutely absurd. I was struck again yesterday by the sheer scale of this. I tweeted it. I don't have the number in front of me, but Jack Dorsey said that I think that they were killing like something like 7 million fake accounts a week. Sheryl Sandberg said, and this goes beyond what they said at F8. At F8, Zuckerberg said they were killing a million accounts a day. And she said yesterday they're killing millions of accounts a day. When you're dealing at that scale, rubles are not going to pop up before your attention. And this isn't about them making money. That's a cynical question in the end, because they don't want this on their back. And you know what they really want, I think, is cover to be able to take things down. Right before we came on the air, Twitter did announce that they're taking down Alex Jones.
Yeah,
that's been a very difficult thing for them to come to. The other platforms did. What they all needed was company. They needed each other to say, "You first, no, you first." And they're doing it. And there's still some controversy about it. Of course, Lord knows there will be. But in the end, I think that though I was one who was rather dogmatic about openness and more speeches, good speech, and so on and so forth, I've come to see that was naive. These bad guys are manipulating the platforms. They're using them. And the platforms are not getting anything positive out of this. They're getting nothing but headaches. And importantly, huge expense. You know, Sandberg also said yesterday it wasn't future tense anymore. She said present tense that they have 20,000 people working on this. And I've used this bad analogy before, and it is a bad analogy. But there are 20,000 people at Facebook now assigned and paid to hunt down and get rid of crap detectors. Meanwhile, in the United States, we have, and it's an apples to kumquats comparison, we have about 30,000 journalists on daily newspapers. And so what does that say about our allocation of resources that we have to these two worlds, to quality news, to playing whack-a-mole with crap? And what it also says is that the investment in dealing with the crap in human labor and in algorithm writing and in getting data sets is huge. And full disclosure, I should mention here, because it's a different show from usual, is that I raised money from Facebook, Craig Newmark, Ford Foundation, and others to start the News Integrity Initiative at CUNY. I am independent of them, and I personally receive no money from any platform. End of disclosure.
So Peter Kafka yesterday, he tweeted a picture of empty seats during the House hearing. Did the reps like have better things to do? Is that what it usually looks like in there? Like it was pretty empty.
Yeah, it is. It's what happens. They have other things to go do, and it's all for the camera. So I don't think it's a huge deal. Did you also see, by the way, Jack's tweet about his pulse?
Yes.
I should have said it into you earlier. I don't have it the ready, but it was very funny that you know, he started off by saying that he was shy. I love that the head of Twitter says, "I'm a man of few words." Of course you are.
Yeah.
And a few more now, but still a few. But he, you know, this, he's not used to doing this. He's not that kind of public figure. And I think that he comported himself well. And Sheryl Sandberg is often accused of being too scripted and too this. I think she too came off very well. I think she came off as quite sincere.
All right. So along with this, man, the last couple of days have just been nutso. There was news that Attorney General Jeff Sessions, you know, and of course we heard about, you know, President Donald Trump saying that Google is actively censoring conservative voices. Jeff Sessions then says, or there was news that he had been meeting with state attorneys general on this topic of platform censorship. Does it seem like there's a march that's pretty hard to steer away from right now towards regulation of these platforms? I mean, so many things are happening all at once, right? We've got election interference. We've got charges of censorship. All these things concurrently happening. Is regulation just like almost a given at this point? What do you think?
Lord, I hope not. And at moments like this, I sound like a libertarian. I enrage some Twit fans because I'm a proven liberal. I'm not against government, but I am against government involvement in speech. I think that it would be a big mistake, number one. And the internet is speech, mm-hmm. Period. That's what it is. Two, I think we've seen in Europe that the regulation that's occurred there, though well-intentioned, has huge unintended consequences. GDPR, the privacy regulation, means that a couple thousand U.S. publishers have now cut off Europe. The right to be forgotten gives more power to Google to decide what should and should not be remembered, which I think is a frightening idea. Netzdegen hate speech law in Germany, besides hiring thousands of people to Facebook, means that satire is all but dead because it gives companies 24 hours to get stuff off. So they're going to play safe and take anything that's edgy off. Those are problems. Those are big problems. And I don't want to see that occur. And I do think that we've got to recognize that we are on the same side. Let me give a caveat to that in a second. And I'll say something controversial, so I already apologize to your email accounts. but we have to see here now that Twitter particularly, Facebook particularly, also Twitter and also Google are our best allies and our best defense against Russian election interference. Our own government in the United States is not a good defense, right? We have major officials starting at the very top saying, Russia, what Russia? Nothing's happening here. And so we've got to recognize, number one, that they are trying to defend us now that they know about it. Number two, when you have Donald Trump going after Google, the same way he has in the past declared the press to be the enemy of the people, he's going after sources of information. He's going after sources of truth and reporting. And so that he has the only truth. Or as Rudy Giuliani says, truth isn't true. So we're in that kind of boat where media and the platforms, which are not the same, I would argue, are on the same side. They're on the same side of fighting manipulation and interference. They're on the same side of trying to inform the public and give people access to information. They're on the same side when it comes to being attacked by authoritarians in this country and elsewhere. So the media, what disturbs me so often is that media has become dystopian and moral panicky about the platforms and is taking pride in smashing them at every turn. Well, folks, they're not the enemy.
I need to go back to what you said about the internet being speech. The internet is speech. Now, you didn't say, free speech is so complicated. Every time I feel like I say, something about free speech, people say, you don't understand free speech. Free speech is not free. And what do you mean by the internet is speech?
So, watch out. I'm going to go on for an hour.
I know I was in trouble asking this question, but I really need to know.
So this is a post that I haven't written yet that I want to write.
Please do.
Which is that, after you hear it, you may disagree.
Okay.
I think that we in media make a mistake and people in government make a mistake of seeing the internet as content. That's viewing the future in the analog of the past. That's Gutenberg terms. Drinking game, whenever I say Gutenberg, yep, you can take a swig. And that sees the world as containers of something called content. That's not what the internet is. The internet is Times Square, not the New York Times. The internet is a place where people come together to connect with each other and with information and to take action and to do things and to buy things. And pardon me, my lights go out because it thinks that I'm dead. Technology. And so just in the middle of my spiel, the lights are editors. I think that to presume that the internet is content also brings other assumptions with that, which including, well, it ought to be edited. Well, it ought to be packaged. It ought to be censored. It ought to be approved. It ought to be perfect. None of that is true. It's just people talking. The fact that anyone who's connected can talk to anyone who's connected. We got a lot more people to connect, but we're headed there. That's very different from saying that a small elite has access to the press and access to create a product we call content that they can publish, in something like a book. That's a very different beast. So I think that we keep on saying that the internet is media. It's not. That the internet is content. It's not. The internet is people talking. And we wouldn't go around Times Square. We wouldn't go to the neighborhood Denny's. And when somebody says something stupid in the next booth, say, stop saying that. You shouldn't say that. That's wrong. I'm going to correct you. Right? We just know people talk. They do what they do. And we've got to see the internet in that context. And we've got to appreciate it for that, that we can now hear voices that couldn't be heard before. Without the internet, we wouldn't have had, as I said, Me Too or the Parkland students' victories. We also wouldn't, as a white person, I wouldn't be as aware as I am now of the problems of white people calling the cops on black people who are just living their lives while black. It's been going on, God, Lord knows, for as long as we've had a telephone. But I wasn't aware of it as much as I should have been because it wasn't documented by media. It wasn't a story in media. It wasn't content. Instead, now we have a medium that enables people to talk. Now, having said that, why do I also celebrate taking down Alex Jones? Because there are standards in society, and society is negotiating those standards. And society has told Twitter and Facebook and company that Alex Jones, we don't know where the line is, but whatever that line is, he's on the other side of it. And the platforms would like us to have rules that they can put into algorithms, but unfortunately it's not as clean as that. And it means that we as society are doing this anecdotally. And we've said Alex Jones is unacceptable in a civilized world. Get him out of there. At the same time, I'm arguing it's speech and I want as much speech as possible. Those are conflicting.
Yeah.
And we're trying to figure out where those lines are.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before your lights go out again, write the internet is speech, write the post, write the book. Just you have to write the book very fast.
I am working on that. Okay. Gutenberg.
or you can write that in a dark office. Just make sure your keyboard's backlit.
Yeah.
That's all.
I have a wonderful Chromebook, so it's okay.
All right. Fantastic. Jeff Jarvis, it's always great getting the chance to talk to you, and I'm happy
always
we got
great.
your insight on this buzzmachine.com. Absolutely. We'll do it again soon. Thanks, Jeff. We'll see you next week on Twig. The title of that episode, by the way, The Internet is Speech. Obviously, Jeff Jarvis mentioned that during the interview, and that's so true. So I think what I appreciate about this story more than anything is how indicative it is of this moment in time where there is this big tech backlash, and 2018 has largely been a year where this kind of pushback has come right up to the top. We've started to really kind of see the effects of this in a number of different ways throughout the course of our lives. And I'm curious now going into 2019 and even beyond to find out how that materializes even more. Do people continue to push back even more, or do people kind of hit a point where like, yeah, tech sucks, but I also really like these things that I get for, you know, my privacy in return for my privacy.
I really think that is going to be the big story of 2019. That's what I know we usually, sometimes in the past have done predictions, but just the fact that we are super frustrated with Facebook and Amazon and Twitter, and yet we're like, meh,
yeah,
still going to use them.
Man, they suck, but I'm going to log in. I'm going to continue to log in. Yes. That's exactly it.
I mean, you're not on Facebook, but have you actually deleted your account yet?
I haven't. I still haven't deleted it. And I keep going back and forth. I want to delete it, but there is something keeping me from doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't go there very often, but I still do occasionally post there, and I'm definitely not ready to delete it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't use Uber anymore, but I use Lyft because it's exactly the same thing. So.
Yeah. Same, same, but different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Tech News Weekly. We're recording live every Thursday starting at 2:30 p.m. Pacific twit.tv/live. We will be here next week after the New Year holidays. We'll be back with more interviews for you then.
Yeah, subscribe to the show. Definitely tell your friends. Make it your New Year's resolution to tell at least one friend about Tech News Weekly. What I usually do, like when I'm out with friends and they're like, oh, I don't know what podcasts are good to listen to, I usually just take their phone and say, you know, subscribe to all of mine. Do that too.
Yeah, when I have parties, I just put this show on repeat on all the TVs in the house.
Yeah.
And then a little informational card next to it that says, here's where you can subscribe.
Yeah.
It works really well.
Yeah, it's the middle of the week. You had whatever holidays you've celebrated. If you're going to celebrate New Year's, I think, and you're going to go to a party, I think putting our podcast on the big TV or just shoving it in people's face on your phone, it's a really nice thing to do.
Yeah, what better way to say Happy New Year than to watch Tech News Weekly when normally you would watch the ball drop. That's it. I'm Jason Howell.
I'm Megan Maroney.
And we don't normally end this way, but we are now. We'll see you in 2019 on Tech News Week. All right, everybody. We only do this once every now and then. We actually have a new survey for you. So since our listeners, like you, are techies, this particular survey focuses on how you use collaborative software at work. It's brief. The survey is super brief. It takes maybe about 6 minutes to do. We're not going to collect any personal data on you. The URL is twit.to/survey and then the number 12. So twit.to/survey12. Plug that in, take the survey, and we really appreciate you doing this. Thank you so much.